we start and use the time. It would be great to have some time to engage in dialogue or question and answers at the end of the three sessions. So we go through the three times 20 minutes, and then we see if we either want to go into a discussion in small groups or if you just want to take questions. Let's see how it goes. So, yeah, I invite you to on stage now, and I'm very curious what you will tell us. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, and good morning. So again, my name is Victoria Dura, and I'm practicing as a hypnotherapist, and I'm doing research into consciousness. And first of all, I would like to say how really, really grateful I am to be here. It's a very touching experience, and I have that feeling that I'm among people who I don't necessarily know. Most of you I don't know personally, but I could be really good friends with you if I did. So I have the feeling I'm talking to friends, and I left my PowerPoint at home because I want to include you into a conversation and invite you to follow the things that I'm saying and then maybe reflect and make up your own mind. Because the topic that I am about to talk is so controversial and there is so little research done on it that literally any kind of input and opinion, I believe, will be really valuable. So what I will talk about is retrocognitions. So when a therapist is practicing and then gets into that curious situation that a client is remembering something that appears to be a past life. So this issue came up like in the 1960s, 70s, when psychology started to open up more to humanistic and transpersonal realms. And then psychologists and practitioners started to bring their clients back to their childhood first. There were relaxation techniques, hypnotherapy techniques, all sorts of body-oriented techniques. And then people were telling about their childhood. And then the surprise happened. As you know, they were beginning to talk about birth, prenatal stages, and then also about a life in a completely different time and a completely different space. So what do we make out of these cases? I mean, the first therapist, there was like one therapist, for example, who made it into her goal to disprove the story, Tavazi, because she said, this client is crazy and needs to be cured of that craziness. So she started traveling and she started to search for facts to disprove. And at the end, she wrote a paper saying that I couldn't disprove anything. All the facts and all the circumstances that the client was reporting about was actually true. And here we get into this absolutely horrible kind of cognitive dissonance where, like Stanislav Grof was using the phrase, when the impossible happens. And to give you a little bit of my background, to make you see how big of a deal this was to me, because I come from a very academically oriented family. So my father is that archetypal scientist who does chemistry and who says, yeah, there's the periodic system and nothing but the periodic system. The world consists of atoms and molecules, and the rest is superstition we inherited from Middle Ages. And I also started my career as a lawyer, so I was completely rational. I wanted to be serious. But I couldn't, because I myself started to have experiences that I couldn't explain. Without taking any drugs or without doing any kind of spiritual practice, I started to have out-of-body experiences. So suddenly I was above my physical body and seeing myself sleep and thought, this is it. You know, everything that I learned before about the nature of reality is not true. So I took the great leap and qualified as a therapist, but I was still in the more conservative realm. So as a hypnotherapist these days, you can do cases that are absolutely accepted by mainstream psychology. If someone has a phobia and you do a systematic desensitization, I don't think any mainstream psychologist today has a problem with that. So I was in that conservative realm until the thing happened to me, that someone started to remember past lives. And I got to a stage where I said to myself, this is it. This is my limit. I do crazy stuff, but this is too crazy. But then I started to remember past lives. So then you start to take it seriously and you ask yourself, how on earth can you put that into some sort of system that is acceptable? I had to get out of seriousness and go into the fooling. And I said to myself, I'm going to make a big fool out of myself because, and I think that was the decisive point, because my curiosity was stronger than my ego. And I still was searching for a sort of intellectual framework which would work. And that's when I realized that we have a much bigger problem here than just some sort of cases showing up. That we are in the middle of a paradigm war. And, you know, paradigm today is quite a household term, but I wanted to go back to the original meaning of that term, as Thomas Kuhn wrote in his famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolution, where he says a paradigm is nothing but a set of assumptions that at any given time we use in the mainstream thinking system. And assumptions are, per definition, assumptions, meaning that they can't be proven. So you can't verify them, you can't falsify them, you can't choose an assumption according to any sort of scientific criteria. The only way you can set your assumptions is by usefulness. So I think we have this very, very strong rational materialistic paradigm at the moment because it has been so useful. We have all this technology. We have spaceships and cars and internet and computers. So it's been very useful and people are clinging onto it. But then the question is it really useful to study consciousness? You know, study cases like out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences or past lives. I was just working with a lady last week who told me the story of her near-death experience. She said she fell from a horse and all the other horses were stampeding over her. She broke all her bones, her skull. In the hospital, they put her together, but when she started to talk about the near-death experience she had, which is a classic, the type we are going to probably hear on Saturday, the doctors told her this is hallucination and she must stop talking about it. She didn't stop talking about it because she was puzzled and disturbed. And she told me that the doctor literally went into her room in the middle of the night, tapped on her shoulders, said, if you don't stop talking about these things, I am going to put you in the psychiatric ward for the rest of your life. And she said she was never so scared in her life. It was a worse experience than the near death. So ask usefulness. Is this useful way of treating someone who has had her most significant experience on her life? Because everybody who has these experiences, they always say, this is the most significant thing that ever happened to me. That's why I started to take the past life cases so seriously. Because you have to witness that amount of emotion that comes up. I will interview some of the people here who are actors and ask them, can they fake that sort of emotion? And people then afterwards tell me that was so significant that they are considering it as part of their biography. So I would say that it's no longer useful to just dismiss these cases as hallucinations and throw them out of the window. So we have to set new assumptions. And I found that new assumptions have to be just two of them. I think we just need two assumptions to make a system like that work. If you assume that consciousness is fundamental, don't say the world is based on matter, but we say the world is based on consciousness. And matter is derivative of consciousness. It might sound like a very hippie or new age kind of thing, but I actually have at home a growing collection of quotes and I was choosing people who got the Nobel Prize in some sort of science, because I thought that, you know, has to convince even the most questioning people. So I have a collection of Nobel Prize laureates who say that. Max Planck said that word by word. I do not believe in the material paradigm anymore. I believe that fundamental in the universe is consciousness. And then as a second assumption, we need evolution. And here's where the wonderful Integral community comes in. That these cases only make sense when there is not just consciousness, but there is an evolution of consciousness. So in this new paradigm, in this consciousness-based paradigm, we can actually begin to work with cases like past lives. There is still a big chunk of critique. And there is one point of critique that even Ken Wilber mentioned somewhere, and it's to be taken very seriously. He says, okay, but these cases do sound like an ego trip. He said, the Dalai Lama can't remember past lives, but Shirley MacLaine can. We have a problem. And I think this is true. From my experience, I gave this whole phenomenon the nickname of Cleopatra cliché. Even people are like, yeah, in my past lives I was Cleopatra, or I was Napoleon, and things like that. It does sound very much like an ego trip, an ego inflation. So while we will deal with this critique, and we will have to deal with this critique, I'm still arguing that this is not a reason to dismiss these cases, because that would be throwing out the proverbial baby with the bathwater. Why that is, I have two main arguments why that is the case. The first is the research that has been done with children who remember past lives. So researchers like Ian Stevenson, and these days Jim Tucker, they are serious academics who have studied cases where a two-year-old child or a three-year-old child is coming up with absolute astonishing details about a past life, and these cases in a surprising number could be verified. I was last year at a conference in Miami with Jim Tucker, who gave a presentation. And that presentation just like blew the roof off, as they say. He had cases where on his PowerPoint he had one column where he listed the things that the child remembered spontaneously, and in the other column the facts that were verified. And it was names, details of the death, details of the place of the death, details of the child, for example, in this case that I'm mentioning, the James Leininger case, the child remembered to have died in World War II. He was citing people from the army that he was fighting with by name, and the father, who was an absolute skeptic to begin with, went to the reunion of that army group to get to know some of the people. He didn't say why he was there, because he felt too embarrassed. And it turned out that some of the old men in there, in that reunion, still remember James Leininger, verified the facts, and not only verified the facts, but when they talked to the little boy, they said, we acknowledge him as one of us. So when you have cases like that, there is no more turning around. You have to take it seriously. You have to do something with that. And then the second argument that I want to bring up is the argument from therapy. Because when you have therapy with people and you find out that remembering past lives is bringing a absolute astonishing therapeutic benefit, then again, you just don't want to dismiss that. You don't want to throw out. In the meantime, I consider this is one of my strongest therapeutic kind of technique and repertoire. So to give you an example from literature, there was a little boy, and he was called Ludovic in the case study, who had what the doctors diagnosed as a minimal brain damage. And they diagnosed this as a minimal brain damage because they had no other label. They had no idea why it's organically happening to this little boy. He was constantly shaking. In her, you know, legs, arms, to the extent that he couldn't walk without crutches, always had to hold onto something, and always said the world is shaking. And parents took him to all sorts of doctors and practitioners, and nothing helped. And then there was a past life regression done with that boy. And it turned out that he remembers to have died in the Hiroshima atomic attacks, where death happened so suddenly that whatever consciousness is responsible for remembering, it couldn't deal with it, so brought it over. The same happened in the James Leininger case that I just mentioned to you, the little boy who died in World War II and remembered crashing his airplane, had absolutely horrendous nightmares as a two-year-old, three-year-old. And that made the parents study his case because no doctor and no psychologist could help him. So when he found out about the others, about the place where he died, it all stopped. Why does it suddenly stop? Again, the therapeutic benefits are so strong that we have to deal with it. So, but we have a paradox here, because I was mentioning to you the critique with the Cleopatra cachet and then these great benefits. So how do we somehow bridge this? How do we deal with that? And you are not going to be surprised with an integral background, that what I found is that it all depends on the level. So I like to work, for example, with the chakra levels. So people like Caroline Miss, they were quite doing quite amazing work with mapping the chakras and each chakra corresponding to certain physical and certain spiritual and certain psychological issues. So when you look at that, you get a hierarchy that you can work with. But it can be translated into an integral map. So you have to like see, okay, on one level is it where the whole thing becomes an ego trip? And what is the level where it actually contributes to some sort of growth? And I found in the chakric level it was the heart. In the integral level it would be probably anything above orange. But what is not so important to like what names we give to these levels, but more what is the turning point? So where is the turning point where someone would benefit from these past life regression therapies? And what is the point where it would be just a game, an ego game? And we found that the tipping point criteria is, we have heard that word quite a few times during this conference, is bodhicitta. So we can do a simple test with anyone. And that simple test comes actually from Pecci, an Italian psychotherapist, who said, I'm just asking people, give me 10 questions. You don't have to answer them, but give me the questions. What are the major interests in your life? And if they are talking about questions that are ego-related, we don't do the therapy. If there are questions that are relating to helping others, understanding the we space, going into that, it will help. So I think for today, my time is over, but I will also talk on... 2 minutes, yeah. I will also talk on Friday in the psychotherapy group. And what I would like to do on Friday, I would like to give you an overview of the actual cases, a little bit what happens to each and every individual who is undergoing such therapy. I'm doing at the moment a research study, as big as one single human being can do, where I take people through a series of past life experiences and I map the changes that come from the past through the present and into the future. So we don't just take these cases in an isolated way. We don't just say, let's find a past life and let's be entertained by it. But we take a couple of sessions. It's a little bit like, you know, when you're doing mathematics in school and we have the coordinate systems and we're putting in the dots and then we were connecting the dots so that we could see what sort of shape it makes. It's that thing that if we take a couple of past lives from someone and we connect them, we usually see a pattern. And a pattern is very interesting because a pattern is connecting to the present and also to the future in a sense of where is that person going? What is the purpose of that person? So I believe that these cases make the most sense when it's helping you or whoever undergoes that to connect you with your purpose and you see where you're going. So thank you very much for your attention.